Welcome back to the Fifth Estate podcast from the Wheeler Centre. In this week's episode, Family Violence Emergency, we'll hear from the Walkley-winning investigative journalist Jess Hill and ask, what are we really doing about family violence? Here's the Fifth Estate's host, Sally Warhaft.
Jess is an award-winning investigative journalist. She's worked at the ABC as a producer, as a journalist, and also at the Global Mail. Jess has won two Walkley Awards for her reporting on domestic violence, and that's before she wrote this book, See What You Made Me Do. And it really is a thrill to have Jess here tonight, so let's give her a warm Wheeler welcome.
Thanks, everybody.
I want to start by reading out a few sentences from the book of yours to speak about. Domestic abuse is a terrifying language that develops slowly and is spoken only by the people involved. Victims may feel breathless from a sideways look, a sarcastic tone, or a stony silence, because these are the signals to which they have become hyper-attuned, the same way animals can sense an oncoming storm. These are the signals that tell them danger is close or that it has already surrounded them. I'm wondering if you can start by talking to us a bit about this form of mental captivity that you describe as a terrifying language.
So it's interesting. I think in our understanding of domestic abuse, we often centre physical violence, even if we acknowledge that other types of abuse occur, financial abuse, psychological abuse, etc. But essentially what you see time and again in these relationships and talking to the women and children inside them is that at the core of this is humiliation and degradation. And actually acts of physical violence and all that only serve to sort of like reinforce the core, but it's that's really kind of around the edges of what's happening inside. And, you know, there's one example is from Evan Stark, who wrote the book Coercive Control, which is sort of that's really the type of domestic abuse I'm referring to when I talk about there being this terrifying language and that it being a quasi-state of captivity. And he talks about a woman who's out at a baseball game. She's playing baseball and she's out there. It gets a bit chilly and he goes out there and says, you know, you should put a jumper on, honey. Now, to everybody else, that's just a man who's going up and caring for his wife. But to her, that was code. To her, that was rich with code that she had exposed herself and that he was now coming to take control of that situation and she'd be punished for it later. So there's all of these sorts of things that are spoken in public, in private, that have backgrounds of threat and humiliation embedded in it like code that is invisible to everybody else. So in the courtroom, for example, and especially in the family law situations where it used to be that perpetrators could, you know, interrogate or cross-examine their victims, they might be able to just use a piece of code that nobody else would pick up on and absolutely send that woman into a trauma response. And completely interrupt her cognition to the point where she may not be able to make any sense. And to the judge and everybody in the courtroom, she would just seem crazy, you know. And I guess that what I really wanted to focus in on in the book were those, you know, it's not enough to talk about rapes or punches or assaults, that actually inside the details that happen between these incidents, that's actually where the abuse and the total assault on the self occurs.
You begin the book, in fact, by explaining the use of your own language and referring to domestic abuse and not simply domestic violence. Mm. But are there issues in even the word domestic?
Yes, from all sorts of different angles. I mean, domestic we take to be something that happens inside a family situation or inside the home, but particularly inside the home. So look, it's a term that is thoroughly incomplete and probably inappropriate. It's the best term that we have. It seems to have hung around. But actually, so if you take it from an Indigenous perspective, I had one woman who works in this in the sector say that they don't like to use the term domestic violence because actually, historically, for Indigenous women, the domestic violence that they would experience was when they were working as domestics on farmsteads, right? And so the domestic violence would come from both the woman who is in charge of the house and the man, and it came in different forms. So they don't like that term. And often we hear about family violence being used in the Indigenous context. I think
I hear sort of domesticated, you know, in a I mean, I know that we don't have enough language, do we, for this?
We're always stuck in the language. Mm. The language cages us. And even when I went to call it domestic abuse, to take it, you know, and that's really taking a cue from police in the UK who've decided to use that term to capture all of those behaviours that I'm talking about before, that it's not just physical. You know, even that, you're making it sound even more benign than domestic violence. It's sort of almost taking the point out of it. But I guess, you know, if you talk about, so we might talk about intimate terrorism, well, that maybe gets closer to an idea of it, but that really only, that kind of only refers to that systemic form of abuse, that coercive control. In a more reactive form of abuse where maybe instigated by alcohol, substance abuse, maybe instigated by arguments where it's not a overall campaign of domination, it's not intimate terrorism. So there's no real catch-all term that actually suits and explains it.
The coercive control is at the highest end of the abuse. It's the behaviour that results in the most harm. Is that a fair thing to say?
I think that mostly when you have a system of control that is basically directed at eradicating self-worth and limiting autonomy and basically reducing liberty, yes, I think we can probably safely say that those systems are the most harmful and the most difficult to recover from. Also, because actually those systems are the most likely to continue after the relationship is finished, because someone who is intent on controlling their partner will not stop just because the relationship is over. Mm. They'll use whatever system they're able to, whether that be family law courts is an obvious one, but it could be Centrelink, it could be making false reports to child protection, it could be trying to screw them through the rental tribunals. I mean, literally every system we have can be exploited by an abuser who has control at the centre of what they're trying to do. So, yes, I would say, and also those controlling behaviours are a much closer indicator of future homicide than just, you know, physical violence.
Tell us a bit more about that then. And I mean, I know that there are, you know, subtypes here. It is so hard to read. It is so hard to, you know, to read this and then go walking about the streets and looking at human beings and wondering about people's lives. You write about and refer to other people's work about cobras, snakes, and pit bulls, and
unfortunate terms, but sometimes helpful in the way what
well,
they describe.
Well, they paint a picture, you know, and you're so clear, as is all the evidence, that these perpetrators come in every imaginable package one can imagine, but they do have features that they all share.
Yeah.
What are some of those?
So, well, I would say that across a lot of perpetrators, you can look to two major features, and that is a radioactive sense of entitlement, even if it's quite invisible to them, and often a victim complex. So what's fascinating about, you know, in the men's referral service here in Victoria, that not only takes calls from men who are concerned about their behaviour, but also calls out to men who've had charges laid or where police have been involved, they almost always start the phone call with the man claiming to be the victim, even if they have literally been charged with an assault. Now, some of these men will use that as a manipulative tool, knowingly, but a lot of these men genuinely believe that if their partner hadn't done XYZ, they would not have reacted or they would not have responded in the way that they did. down to the sense that, like, oh, well, if she wasn't so, you know, such a slut, I wouldn't have put a GPS tracker in her car. I wouldn't be surveilling her every movement. You know, it's always a response to I'm being victimized and I'm now in my rights to respond. So that's they're two that are common. I guess when I started writing the book, I felt like, you know, as we say, language is a trap. We also need to categorize things. Mm. You know, our brains, unfortunately, it's very hard for us to think about sort of just gray area, because that just, it's just a blur of stuff that we need to sort of try to put things into observable patterns. So I was like, okay, is there an observable pattern within perpetrators or within men who use control and violence? And essentially, a lot of the best kind of research that you come across centers on three basic types. They center on a man who has profound issues with intimacy, who is reactive, or who has, like, you know, quite strong ideas around privilege and entitlement, and will just use violence to get their way. But they all sort of belong to a bit of a sense of, like, they're just going to use violence in certain situations to get what they want or to overwhelm senses of shame or frustration. They're not the ones who institute systems of control. In coercive controllers, so the men who really do sort of, you know, they're the men who isolate, who surveil, micromanage their partner's activities, who threaten, degrade, etc., they all tend to repeat the same patterns. It's like, you know, shelter workers will talk about it being like a script. The woman starts telling her story and they're like, we can just tell the story back to her. We've heard it so many times, right? But interestingly, this same script comes from two basic types of people who are coming from very different perspectives. So the first type, and what you referred to as the cobra term, I'll explain it in the capacity of this study that was done, which looked at cobras and pit bulls. I just like to caveat it, saying that we shouldn't actually be calling people cobras or pit bulls. It's more that it's a description of the behaviour. So I don't think it's helpful to sort of like put them in that package, but I do think this study kind of illuminates quite a lot. And it was essentially, it was a study done in the early 90s by Dr. John Gottman and Neil Jacobson from the famous Gottman Institute, done a lot of work on couples and relationships. And they essentially got about 67, I think, coercive controllers and their partners. And they basically invited them into a lab and asked them to fight, which is like an unimaginable research study now. I don't know how they got ethics to do that, you know, like, it's like, what could go wrong? You can imagine. So they got them into a lab to fight, and they hooked them up with these physiopathology machines, like measuring sweat, heart rate, you know, everything kind of imaginable about the physical responses. And then also they coded their responses, their verbal responses, their body language, etc. It was quite elaborate. And they found that of the 67 coercive controllers, they could split it into two basic patterns. One was about 20% of the group and the other one was 80%. 20% of the group was the men that they called cobras. They called them cobras because their violence was their control. They weren't physically violent in the lab, but their control and their aggression came up very quickly, and then they struck like really sadistically and sort of mercilessly.
These are the men that kill their partners.
Yeah, well, they both do. Right. But, you know, so the cobras basically, their anger would come out of nowhere and it would just be explosive. The heart rates for these men, as they became more and more aggressive in the lab, their heart rates lowered. So the more aggressive they became, the more calm they became internally. And what they sort of ascertained from that is that actually being in control is what feels most natural and normal to that person. It's a state that they seek out. Now, that heart rate result wasn't replicated in other studies that have looked at it, which apparently is because those labs weren't, you know, as high tech. Who knows? But that was something they found with these guys repeatedly. Now, that may be because there's sociopathy, psychopathy, et cetera, in their backgrounds, and they did find a lot of that sort of quite extreme disordered behaviour. But what they found with that guy is that he's not really necessarily attached to the person in an intimate way. He wants someone to control. And once that person is gone, he's probably not going to stalk that person.
He's just going to replace her.
He's going to replace her because it's actually too hard. It's like what he was getting from it is now kind of over, and it's too hard to keep going for that, and there's too many other fish in the sea, right? And people, men in jail have talked about literally, once I get out of here, I'm going to go and find myself a new one, you know, like. So that was one type. The other type, the pit bull type, was the 80%. And I'd say, like, generally speaking, we find that to be much more of the norm. These were the paranoid, insecure, codependent types who were desperately afraid that their partners were going to leave them, and they instituted a system of control partly as a way to prevent their partner from going off and cheating with somebody else, or from preventing their partner from actually seeing them for who they are, which they sense basically to be deeply unlovable. So these guys have a pretty like strong inbuilt sense of shame, of a sense that basically if anyone were to see behind the mask that they've sort of like kept on ever since maybe they were a kid for various different reasons, that they would find that there's nothing there to love, and that there'd be nothing stopping them from leaving. And by the time they've actually convinced someone to love them and to be in a relationship with them, they're just going to hold on. And they're going to basically keep every other bastard at bay. So it's like, give me your phone, delete all your male contacts, go, as one guy said to a woman that I spoke to, go and tell this colleague that you seem to be quite fucking friendly with that you hate him and that you're going to file a report against him. Like, basically just, like, completely isolate them from any other threats. And then this ongoing system of control builds quite – it sort of emerges from these guys – so the cobras, they do it quite instrumentally. They do things knowingly. They know that they're dangerous. The pit bulls don't know they're dangerous, but they do the same things. But the behaviour emerges. They don't do it like I'm waking up in the morning thinking how I'm going to hurt and humiliate my partner. They do it in response to like back off, keep you, keep this situation under control. But they repeat the same behaviours. Mm.
Unlike the perpetrators, not one researcher in your entire work has ever been able to find a victim type.
Mm.
And so tell us about that. I mean, that's an astonishing thing, isn't it?
Yeah, because, I mean, we all have, you know... Well, I think I had ideas in my mind about what victims probably looked like. They probably had issues with codependency. They probably had, you know, probably in some shameful moments before I even started looking at this, probably thought like, oh, they like the drama, you know. I mean, awful things that we think about victims, partly I think as a self-defense mechanism to us and them, you know. It's like... they have gotten in this situation because of the nature of their personality, and therefore it could never happen to me because I would never allow myself to get into that situation. I would not attract that. So it's all about what do the victims attract, you know. But when actually so many of the women that I have spoken to, and I'm not saying that codependent type, I mean, there are women who've like grown up with violence who actually feel like when they're in safe and normal relationships, they feel unsafe. Because I feel like that something's wrong. This is not what I'm used to with intimacy. So there's all types, there's lots of different things going on. But I guess the biggest subversion of the expectation is that there are women who are actually taken, their strength is what is taken advantage of. Their ideal of themselves and their self-idea that they are strong women who are capable of fixing this guy, who make a guy their project and basically do everything they possibly can to, you know, amend his behaviour and help him look at his behaviour, believing that they alone, through their strength and intelligence, will be able to reconnect this guy with trust and with a sense of his own, you know, connection with intimacy, like that's actually a really common profile. And it's, so that's, you know, the fact that like one woman in the book, I call Sarah, she was with a guy I've called Carl, you know, she was a doctor and she worked in a trauma ward. She saw domestic violence all the time. She was with her partner for quite a while and he was great guy, charismatic, funny, full believer in female empowerment, everything you want. And then one day she falls pregnant and he turned on a dime, like literally that classic Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde transformation. And she could tell what it was. So unlike a lot of women who are not quite aware of what's going on, which is completely normal and not a failing on their part, but for her, she knew the signs. So she was like, hang on a minute, you're becoming abusive. It was physical, it was sexual, it was degradation, it was things like threatening suicide if she was inviting friends around. Like it was extreme. But she decided, okay, I know this is domestic abuse, I'm going to get him counselling. I'm going to tell everyone, my, you know, my gynecologist, my doctor, everyone's going to know about it, his family, my family, our friends. It was not a secret. And basically, even as everyone was watching him for like, you know, improvements and all the rest of it, and they all thought through all this help, he was getting better, but they weren't seeing what he was like at home. And essentially it got so bad that one day there was this episode of Q&A that was a special on domestic abuse. He blew up and said all the women who were killed this year, they deserved it, and it was actually the men who were the victims. And understandably, she was quite alarmed by that perspective. She called the psychologist who was a specialist DV psychologist in Melbourne, one of the best, and she said what had happened. He said, well, I think that's probably quite a normal reaction that many men would have had to that episode. And she was like, really? Doesn't feel normal. And so she reported it to police. I mean, she's done everything right, okay? Mm. She tells me that she basically treated him like a psych patient. She made sure he had time to go to the gym. She made sure all his food was cooked, everything. But she thought she could fix him. And then a week later, their young daughter who had breathing issues and had a really troubled health through her infancy, she was crying and she sort of wouldn't stop crying, and they finally got her to go to sleep. She started crying again, and then he jumps out of bed, jumps into the crib and shakes the baby above his head like in a back and forth motion so hard that she's convinced that like her baby is about to die. So she runs in, grabs it out of his hands. He sort of looks sheepish, goes back to bed. She has to secretly call the ambulance because if he finds out that she's called the ambulance, she's afraid he will kill both of them. And she's sitting there saying goodbye to her baby in that moment, just thinking, this might be the last time I have with my little girl. And at that same time, quietly whispering to 000, trying to get help. Mm. You know, she went from being a successful doctor who was married to a wonderful, funny, charismatic man to she left, I mean, immediately after that, there was like, there's no fixing this and I'm not staying. But the amount of time she had to manage all the court visits, all the stuff that, like, she had to go and, you know, obviously file charges, that was a full-time job. Then she had to make sure, because she didn't know this man has dual residency, she had to make sure that the daycare have a safety plan, that if he shows up, they call the police. Doesn't ever feel comfortable going shopping with her, that he may turn up and abduct her. And then after I'd interviewed her, he filed for family court access. And so she then had to spend over $100,000, even though this guy was convicted for assaulting the child. Mm. She had to spend $150,000 protecting her child, absolutely terrified that he was going to get unsupervised access, convinced that she would be the next Darcy Freeman, because she's like, I know what happens. If everything's fine, oh, he's a wonderful doting father. He'd turn up to these visits that she would orchestrate to make sure that she's keeping everyone, you know, happy. He would change the little girl's clothes to make it look like that they'd been hanging out on various occasions and post all those photos on Facebook, you know, so, and then bring those photos to court to show that this is a loving, doting father. And she's like, if I'm not there and, you know, she has a bit of attitude or talks back, what's going to happen? So I tell that story just to say that, I mean, this woman is like one of the most resilient and incredible women I've ever met. There is no reason why she should have been more vulnerable to domestic abuse than any other person I've ever met, including myself. There were no red flags. It just happened.
So what do women need to escape this? I mean, because most women don't even begin with the resources this woman had.
And she was left impoverished. She was living on food vouchers.
Yep. So what are the absolute essentials that a woman needs to be? I mean, you talk so much and so brilliantly about, you know, asking women why they stay is the wrong question. But it's a question, it's the question everyone has, sure, of course. What is it that women need to leave?
Well, I mean, what do they need to leave? Sometimes $3 in their pocket and like a taxi fare, or, you know, like, I mean, what do they need to actually leave and just get out of the immediate sense of danger? Nothing. But what do they need to leave and actually lead a dignified life?
Dangerous time.
It's the most dangerous time, especially if you think about those guys who are, you know, very attached with an almost infantile need for that person. Them leaving is an extreme provocation. So what do they need? Well, for example, many of these women are being tracked. So, for example, in one of the refuges in Victoria, actually, that this private security group, protective group, is working with in collaboration with the Salvos, 80 to 85% of the women that they worked with were being tracked either through their phones or through their cars. So what do they need? They need a security specialist to sweep their car and their phone to make sure that they're not being surveilled. What the ACTU says is they need $18,000 as an average amount to actually leave. They need 10 days at least off work. I mean, this is like the bare basics. Like, this is for the best case scenario. I mean, if you take in what do they need to leave and then protect against a family law application, maybe $300,000. Like, is literally, like, I've had women who do not come from a lot of money, but maybe their family has a house. I have one woman I spoke to, her partner was convicted of assaulting her 18-month-old baby and holding a samurai sword to her throat. And she had to spend, her family had to sell their house to cover the family law fees. She spent 8 years in family law court. They also, unfortunately, because often they're fleeing and maybe don't feel safe in the house, it depends on which state you live in. Tasmania has a great safe at home program. There are different ways to try to keep them safe in the house. But if they've left and there's no way to get back to the house, or it's a rental property and they can't afford to keep it because they don't maybe have an income or they don't have control over the money, then they need a place to be safe. And refuges commonly have been a place not only of safety and where there's, you know, literally security gates, security cameras, you know, concealed address, but actually people who understand what they've been through, caseworkers who will say, these are your next steps, or here's a toothbrush, here's some pajamas, we'll look after your kids, have a shower, you know, like that sort of thing tells the woman that first and foremost, your dignity is going to be taken, is going to be restored. The dignity of your children is going to be restored. You have a way out of this that does not end up with you being homeless. That's the feeling that they get. Unfortunately, right now, instead of having a refuge system that can respond like that, we have a refuge system that is so overburdened by the need and so little affordable housing. Like, one woman I met recently had been in refuge for a year in a women's refuge because there was nowhere for her to move into, like no affordable housing. So there's these backlogs. So actually these women are being sent to motels and they're being sent to boarding houses and they're being sent to places where they're also sending parolees. Like literally they have found in New South Wales and Victoria – women who have been in the same, women and children, let's say, there's actually often more children in these places than women, that they are being sent to places where reformed criminal or paroled criminals are sent. There are fights, there is drug dealing, there is like the most unimaginable situation for a highly traumatized cohort of people to be sent into. So what do they do when they get to those places? What would any of us do? Someone that we've been with, who actually we probably still have some loyalty or affection for, possibly, maybe none, but maybe some connection and maybe even love for, we've made a choice to go, fuck it, I can't keep doing this. The children aren't safe. I'm not safe, whatever it is. I've got to leave. Then they go into a place like that. And what are they looking at? Destitution, further humiliation, a future for their children that is utterly uncertain. And what's back at home? It's the devil they know. You know, so a lot of these women will go back, and it's absolutely a choice of governments not to properly fund that sector and to keep that sector so poorly funded and to keep them in a state where they actually feel greedy just for asking.
It's almost like a reflection of what's going on in the houses to some extent.
It 100% is. Right. I think it's a totally abusive relationship both with the sector and by extension with the people who experience this violence, because it's like, oh, you know, we can't look. There's a lot of things that the government needs to fund. Mm. We can't really afford to properly fund the refuge sector, really. Like, oh, but you can afford $50 billion in tax cuts, or you can afford to spend $20 billion extra on building submarines in a different place than you were originally planning to.
Well, I mean, however you think you might find the funds, if you don't find them, you're tolerating abuse of women and children.
Of course, and it's not actually that much money that we're looking at. It's a few hundred million dollars to restore a refuge sector.
So what about the broader frame then of Australia and how it's looking at this overall, and there is a gaze at the moment.
Totally, there's a lot of work.
And so Australia looks at this quite differently to America. This is something I really did not know about, where we look at it through the gender equality lens. So if we can only get gender equality, then all this will go away. And then, of course, you show the statistics for Nordic countries, which are just as bad, if not worse. Mm. What are we getting right in Australia and how we're looking at it and approaching it, and where are we way off the mark?
So I think that the gender analysis is fundamental and very important. And where we don't see that happening, actually in the Nordic countries, funnily enough, they don't have a very strong gendered analysis of violence. They don't think that, like, for example, you need shelters, particularly for women that, you know, so there's a very, it's a very sort of strange approach over there. It's almost like gender equality has already been achieved. So domestic violence and things is seen as like, and it's like an inconvenience almost, like it's an outlier, like that's not supposed to be happening in our countries that are gender equal. So in Australia, I think the primary prevention model, which is really about attitude change and changing gendered norms, I think that is a amazing and quite radical project, and I'm totally for it. What I'm not so for is that it is foregrounded instead of foregrounding secondary, like interventions at the point of violence. That sort of prevention where it's like, well, what are we doing with the men? How are we like actually intervening at the point of violence, or how are we deterring the violence from occurring? So instead of really just focusing on like, well, let's stop it before it starts, let's stop the next generation from becoming violent, like that's an amazing ambition, but it's experimental. And we actually don't know if it will work. And at the moment, we're 9 years into a national plan that's supposed to go for 12 years to reduce violence against women and children, and it's not being reduced. And actually the government's just said, well, actually we've got 3 years to go, but we're not going to reduce statistics. It's just not going to happen, and we're not going to see any reduction until gendered norms change, right? in 10 plus years. So sorry, this generation of children growing up with complex trauma and violence, and sorry to this generation of women who are being killed and assaulted. Well, there's nothing we can do until every man becomes a feminist. I don't know. Anyway, I'm a little bit jaded on that front. And it's pretty interesting coming from especially a federal coalition government, which for all intents and purposes does not seem to have a great focus on changing norms around gender. Anyway, that aside, so what are they doing right? I think that there's incremental change and quite promising change in police forces in the way that they respond to it, but it's still hit and miss.
I mean, there seems to be sort of best practice here, there and everywhere around the world for the parts of this that are needed. The protective policing, is it in Brazil?
Yeah, in Argentina, all through Latin America.
Women-only police stations and that are designed for victims, not for getting perpetrators.
So, yes, that's right.
But those sorts of things here are not routinely sort of really seriously looked at?
No, and I guess that, you know, we've been going on, we're sort of just, we keep on pushing more sophisticated versions of the same basic system. Like, so we're like, we're going to enhance these systems, or we're going to make the police, we're going to better educate the police, or we're going to, you know, we're going, we'll do bits and pieces of collaboration, or we'll try to enhance information sharing, which is just an enormous undertaking that takes a lot of, yeah, money, funnily enough, but it's also, it's very difficult. But what I'm curious about is that, like, people think about something like a women's only police station, right? Which is like basically this whole form of protective policing, which says we're going to center the needs of the victim. If the victim wants us to just go around and talk to the perpetrator, if they want us to go and get him out of the house, if they want to lay charges, whatever it is that they need in this moment is what we will do. We will also act as a advisory sort of, you know, as an advisory force, and, you know, sometimes give victims advice on whether they should be leaving. Is this the most safe situation for you? You know, but they don't sort of make them fit into a system that's fundamentally incompatible with the experience of violence. So police here, most of the time they need the victim to fit into their system, which is like take out an intervention order, leave, you know, lay charges, show up at court, etc. And for a lot of women, it's like, I don't want to leave the relationship. I want the violence to stop. Or I can't leave because threat of family law system or whatever it is. They have their own issues going on. Or if you're disabled, he's my carer. Who's going to care for me? You know, so there's all these sorts of mitigating issues. But we keep on saying, well, and that's why, you know, police will get this attitude like she's a nuisance. She's a nuisance caller. She keeps on calling, but she keeps on going back to him, et cetera, et cetera. So for me, I'm like, if we've got 20% of women currently being victimised calling police, only 20%, and there's a police call out every 2 minutes in Australia, so just think about that. If that's the way it is, and even with all the improvements in policing, then I think it's radical and incredibly harmful to just keep on trying to push this same system, right? It's not working. So, and we know that actually involving police is the best way for a woman to attain a type of safety. It shows the perpetrator, if it's done well, that they're not the most powerful person in the room, you know. So, but why not just trial a few women's police stations in some of the high violence areas and see what happens?
The policing system that most grabbed my attention in the book was in
High Point in North Carolina.
High Point, North Carolina, and the Al Capone method of policing. Tell us about that, because I mean it's remarkable in so many ways. It's been very, very successful, but primarily for taking the responsibility away from the woman.
Yeah. The point is, like, at the heart of this strategy is it shouldn't be the responsibility of the victim to look after her own safety, right? Because actually we often know who these guys are, and police know who they are, the sector knows who they are, and yet it's constantly on the woman to maintain her own safety. So this this strategy in High Point is called focused deterrence, and it started off as a response to gun crime quite separately, And what they found is that, you know, gun crime was one of those intractable crimes. It was very difficult to reduce, no way to, like, and the idea was these offenders can't change, they won't change. Focused deterrence kind of came at it with a carrot and stick type of methodology, and that was to get the community, the police and the judiciary all working together and delivering two basic messages. One is that, you know, we love you and respect you, we believe in you and we want you to come back into the community and stop your violence and stop your offending. And if you don't, then you will have these people to answer to.
And but this is all done in a public hall.
Yes, all done in a public hall. So there'd be public call-ins. Mm. So in these, when it was in gun crime, they'd have actually gang members in a public town hall meeting. They'd have the community members, ex-bikies, Freemasons, Baptist preachers, etc., coming and saying to them, you know, you need to stop your violence, but we love you and respect you and we'll help you. If you have drug problems, we'll help you with the drug problems. Substance abuse, whatever it is, unemployment, we will help you with whatever you need. But if you don't choose to take our help or you choose to keep offending, the justice response will be swift and it will be severe. And there will be no loopholes.
They can't find a charge to fit, they'll go to the FBI.
Mm. They will close the loopholes entirely. So in the gun crime example, they reduced it. They ended up reducing gun crime by 60%, which is it's still seen as the most effective strategy in America to reduce gun crime. So one day in High Point, there'd been two double homicides in a fortnight in this city. People were just shocked. They were like, how did this happen? How has this city become like this? They had an over average domestic homicide rate. The deputy chief of police, they'd used focused deterrence on their drug markets and it had worked really well. So he was like, couldn't we use this on domestic abuse? Couldn't we just try? And he managed to convince the chief of police to come out and declare domestic abuse the number one public safety threat. And over a period of about 2 years, this deputy chief of police basically orchestrated like peacemaking and collaboration with all of these sectors that had been operating at cross purposes and alone with no information sharing. You know, it brought them all together for regular meetings to the point where they were working all in tandem. As Sal was saying, like the FBI, the federal marshals, public prosecutors, victim advocacy services, drug and alcohol, everybody, right? They all got to know each other and they were all working from the same page. So in the domestic violence example, that public town hall call-in, they had 12 perpetrators sitting down the front of this public community meeting and again had the community members filing in saying, we're against domestic violence but we're for you, we want to help you. And then the law enforcement filing in, FBI, alcohol, tobacco, firearms, all of those people basically all sitting in a row, one by one, telling them exactly how they were closing the loopholes and that if they continued to offend, this is what would happen to them. The federal marshals are like, we've got you flagged. If you cross state lines, you'll be picked up. Minor traffic offence, you're going to be picked up immediately. FBI was like, look, I can buy guns, I can buy dope, I can plant things on you all day long. Like if I need to, if I can't pick you up for your domestic violence offending because our justice system isn't up to it, I'll find a way. The district attorney, I'm pretty sure it was Walt Jones, the district attorney, said, you remember Al Capone, biggest mobster in Chicago, right? And we couldn't get him what he was doing. He died in prison because of tax evasion. Mm. Well, if you choose to keep offending, we will find anything in your record and get you on it, right? So it was like this sort of, we love you, we're going to terrify the shit out of you. And it was... What it was doing was showing that basically there are two roads to take here, right? And the choice is clear. And the prosecutor's office, they were there with the judges, they would flag these as priority cases, right? So there was no sense that you're going to get away with this. And they would actually, the police would work with neighbours, friends, etc., to make sure there were eyes on this couple. So key to this whole strategy was the visibility of perpetrators, the visibility of what was going
on. Just random knocks on the door to see how things are going.
Yeah, and so over time, what happened is I think it was, so they had on average about three domestic homicides a year. For a city of 100,000, that's quite high. In the 8 years after the strategy was brought in, they reduced that by 2/3. And of the 8 homicides that occurred, 7 were people that had never come into contact with the justice system. Some were people who'd just been coming through town, but only one had actually done it after they'd been brought into this system. And what the chief of police there said was that we are fairly confident now that if we can get them engaged, we can prevent homicide.
Can they prevent violence?
Yeah, so this is the interesting thing, right? What was interesting, and control is another one, because obviously that's invisible, you know, but they actually, so a lot of this was about engaging with the victim. And what the victims are saying is that because of the increased visibility and because of the increased, like, the fact that it was very clear that this relationship was between the city and the perpetrator and had nothing to do with them anymore. It was sort of out of their hands, you know. Because of that, the violence did reduce, you know, because they know if they're caught offending again, they're going to go down.
And so what is it, do you think, in that that works? Is it fear? Is it shame? Is it...
It's actually love. It's actually showing that there is an alternative to the way that you're living, right? But it's giving the motivation to change your habituation to violence, right? So it's like you can't just, like, a law and order of, sort of response on its own is not going to work, because there's no sense of, like, any way out. So some of these men need trauma counselling. Some of them do need substance abuse sort of stuff. There's lots of ways of coming at these guys and helping them resolve some of the issues that are contributing to their choice to use violence or their reasons for using violence or control. You know, some guys are fundamentally unreformable.
Yes.
And maybe they do need just to be put away, you know, and used as an example of, like, you know, here's the mugshot, that's the guy who's in there for that, you know, don't be like him. But actually, like, what works is both. And what works is having the data, understanding what you're looking at, who are the people who are causing the most harm, how do we make sure that we really keep eyes on them, who, like, having, organising the data, having the collaboration, case managing everything and working very closely with the victim's safety in mind at all times, that's this sort of magic alchemy that seems to be really effective. Like, and it works in other strategies that aren't just focused deterrence, like justice reinvestment. They're very similar. Got to be it's got to be owned by community. It's got to be place-based, so it's got to respond to the conditions of the place. And it's got to be informed by data and it needs to be consistent.
And a priority.
And a priority, as it already is.
And a leader too, like this one. I mean, he seemed like
you need a person.
Very, very impressive individual. Well, to bring it back to Australia and in fact, our own dear leader just today, announced a review into the family law court and system, I wondered what your response to that is. I found that chapter on the what happens in the family court to be probably the most disturbing. There was serious competition for that, but it was shocking because these are things that we can have control over how that system works. The failings in it were monstrous.
Monstrous.
At first I saw the review today and I thought, well, isn't that fantastic? And then I just thought, hang on, didn't we just have a review?
Mm.
Isn't there a review sitting on somebody's desk?
How many reviews are we doing? Mm.
So tell us about the family law system.
Well, to be just very quick in summarising this, Hetty Johnston from Bravehearts, which is the child abuse organisation, against child abuse advocacy organisation in Queensland, she calls it the most dangerous institution for children in the country. Basically, the family law system is, and I call it Through the Looking Glass, that chapter, because it is like going, like you're Alice in Wonderland, you've gone into a world that's entirely upside down. So women are told by child protection, if they come to their alert, that if they're in a violent relationship, they must protect their children and get them away from the violence. So they must get the perpetrator out of the house or they must leave, whatever. And then they go, so they leave. And then they go into the family law system, and the family law system says you must enable contact with that same person, otherwise we will remove the children. We'll consider you hostile, perhaps. I mean, that's not in the legislation anymore, but I think it's very much still underpinning a lot of their responses. And we may take your children away from you if you try too hard to prevent contact. Like, it's just like these systems are working at cross purposes. And again, you see, the pattern is essentially mother and often child allege sexual abuse, physical abuse or history of domestic abuse. Perpetrator and his lawyer counter-allege parental alienation, that actually there has been no history of that, and or if there has been, the mother is too hung up on it and she has worked it up in the child's mind so that the child is unreasonably afraid of the parent. Then when that is accepted, in so many cases that I've looked at, the family law system has taken the children away from the mother, who in some of these reports and rulings has no other issues present with their parenting. One woman very briefly, one story is that one woman that I wrote about, she was seen to have been alienating her children who had alleged child sexual abuse. She'd actually caught her partner molesting her young child, and that's why she'd left. Then she'd had disclosures from her children. They were disclosed in a family report. The family report writer had said this is a situation of parental alienation, basically, and if we want to preserve a relationship with the father, the children must be removed immediately and without notice. This was done in a secret hearing. The mother was not notified. There was no, she was not present, and essentially it was the family report writer and the judge. A ruling was made, and the next day, I'm not sure if police were sent to the school, but basically the children were called up to the principal's office and their father was waiting for them, and the principal later wrote this letter saying that he will never forget the look of betrayal on the children's faces when they saw their father waiting for them. This is a guy who had not had primary care of them for years, had had very patchy like interactions with them. They didn't know him. They were then sent to live with their father exclusively, and their mother was prevented from even speaking to them for 2 months. Their grandparents were prevented from speaking to them for 5 months. To the point where when it was the little girl's birthday and they're thinking like, they don't understand. They're like, are they still alive? Do our grandparents care about us? And her grandfather, so as he didn't breach the family court order, had to play happy birthday on his trumpet down the phone to her. That was the only way he could be present. They had been present in those children's lives every day, their whole life. And in that family report, it said there are no other problems with that mother's parenting. So I have seen that story play out again and again and again and again, and I get letters and emails incessantly from women who are terrified of losing their children and who then do lose their children because they have alleged abuse or because their children have alleged abuse. I've had children who have threatened suicide, who have been raped in the care of the custodial parent, who have gone to police and police have said, there's nothing we can do, there's a family court order in place. Like, it is absolutely a nuts system. And for a family review to be being held now, only 2 years after there was a review into the family law system and its effect on family violence chaired by Sarah Henderson, like, for that review to be focused and to be responding to a call from Pauline Hanson about the bias against men in the system, I find to just be absolutely sickening. And to have then that review chaired by Kevin Andrews is like, for me, it's like the terms of reference don't show up any major red flags, and in fact they seem quite reasonable. But I think you only need to look at the setup. that it's responding to Pauline Hanson, that Kevin Andrews, who compared like same-sex relationships to the relationship he had with his cycling mates, I mean, like, this is not a man who, A, like, so how's he going to respond to the issues around same-sex relationships in family law? Like, I mean, he's not, for me, he's not actually a man of sound mind, let alone any sort of, like, legal, you know.
Well,
sorry, Kim, don't sue me, please. But, like,
yeah, I'm not going to agree with that.
Yeah. But now, in terms of understanding love and relationships, I don't think he has a sound approach. Let me put it that way. I don't think he's insane. I just think that his approach is not sound and it's not informed by evidence. And so I feel like to put him in charge of that is a signal that this is a sop to the right wing of the party. It's a sop to Pauline Hanson. And my fear is that even if it doesn't actually result in anything changing, because the last review didn't result in anything changing from what I've noticed.
What would result in a change? What would be the most sort of urgent change then that could help everyone? Because it is a complete. There are such risks in any form that it's going to take, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean that's what. Well,
to men as well as women.
So I think that like that's why there's a call for a royal commission, because actually we don't have like an agreed set of facts of what's happening, and actually because the family law courts operate under this cone of silence. So the expert report writers, for example, who write the family report, which assesses the dynamics of the family, which then goes to the judge, and is really one of the most important pieces of evidence. So these people who write these reports, some of them are excellent. Some of them have absolutely fundamental understandings of domestic abuse and the dynamics of child abuse, and they write wonderful reports. A good number of them, however, have no expertise, and worse, lawyers actually know who to go to if they are representing a perpetrator. They know which family report writer is going to cover over any allegations and paint the woman as anxious or even psychotic. Like, so this system of family report writers, I think, is where a lot of the rot starts. There's no standards. I asked the Deputy Chief Justice, why aren't there minimum standards for education or training on this? And he just didn't know what I was talking about. He's like, but they're psychiatrists. Or that I'm like, but half of the psychiatrists in Australia have fewer than 2 hours training on the issue of family violence. So why is being a psychiatrist the qualification? So I would say that we need to have a family report writing system where you have minimum standards, you have people who are actually experts in these dynamics, and that their interviews are not just written down on notes, but they are recorded, that they are accountable, and that there is a complaint system in place. You know, that's fundamental, and that's just the beginning.
You've got very positive things to say about the Victorian Royal Commission. Tell us what is impressive, what's working for you with that, and is it a model for the rest of the country?
I think that the Victorian Royal Commission, it had the public support, thanks in large part to, I mean, decades of advocacy, people like Phil Cleary and others, but obviously Rosie Batty, you know, really pushed that over, and it was the state was ready. So the Victorian Royal Commission, I think, I mean, it's an unprecedented event worldwide to have that, and then to have the recommendations followed up on is quite incredible. I think some of the stuff that's being done around information sharing, around greater interventions with men, there's 227 recommendations and they're rolling out. I think the Orange Doors are interesting. That's like a hub for women to go to that has every service there. I'm not sure that they're being done exactly right, or that there's enough effort going into like peacemaking between all of the different services that are being pushed into these one-stop shops. Because I think there's a bit of a rush to get all this stuff done. So I think a lot of it is very positive. The risks, I think, is that we bureaucratise a system that actually a lot of its strength is in the fact that it is strongly feminist. So unfortunately, with the Royal Commission and the funding that's come off the back of it, I mean, a lot of that funding's gone to police and has gone to government agencies. So it's not, I mean, that amount of money sounds very impressive, and it is, but it's not like it's going to the entire sector, and a lot of the sector is still struggling. Having said that, there is a lot more momentum and a lot more support for a lot of programs that are doing a lot of good. And, you know, I speak in other states, like I come from Sydney and I speak in New South Wales, and I feel like we are just like years behind where Victoria is. It just feels like there is this sense that this is a priority here, and it's sort of yet to be seen how effective it is. I hope and pray that it is effective, because I think if it's not, it's going to prove something that we don't want to see proven, that spending money and putting all this effort in doesn't work. The one thing that I'm concerned about is that especially from primary prevention angle, but also just that I'm not sure from the women's sector angle that there's enough of an understanding of men. And just, I know we're sort of running out of time, but one example of that is there was a Respect Victoria ad, which looks at, there's a guy in a bar, you might have all seen it, and he's talking to his wife disrespectfully. It's all the red flags, you know, it's like, don't speak over me, I've given you enough money this week, all this stuff. And the men are sitting in the bar and they've got their arms folded, and he gets off the phone and one of his mates is like, you know, that's not on, mate. And he's like, oh, it's just a joke. And they're like, it's not a joke, right? And then it's shut down and the conversation moves on, change subject type of thing. Now, like, I watched that ad, and understanding what I know about a lot of abusers, I'm like, so that guy's just been shamed by his friends for how he spoke to his wife. What happens when he goes home to his wife? You know? And it's one of those things, I don't like the term virtue signalling, but that ad to me is speaking to women. It's not speaking to men. It's saying to women, yeah, men should tell your husband off for talking to you like that. But it's reinscribing the same dynamic, which is men police other men, men have power over other men. Mm. Instead of going like, why don't we model what it would look like for men to meaningfully engage that guy and go, hey, mate, that's not like you. Like, why are you talking to her like that? Like, you know that's not cool, right? And have a conversation, not just like, it's not on and we don't like guys like you, exiled. Not to mention the fact that that guy might be leader of the pack, you know, in the pecking order of that group. And if a guy is to say that's not on, he might just be like, well, fuck you, mate. And all the other guys might be like, yeah, fuck you, you know. It doesn't work like, not, you know, it doesn't necessarily work like this utopia of like all the men going, no, that's not on, you know. So I just think that, like, I'd like to see more modelling of the positive kinds of masculinity and masculine engagement, which actually subverts the whole patriarchal thing of power over and policing and all the rest of it, and shows what it's like to open heart spaces and make it safe for guys to engage and talk openly about what's going on for them.
It's a reminder too that every single thing in this area has a consequence, you know,
whether
it's an ad or a cultural change where, I mean, we know that there's been repercussions because of the much more public conversation around this that have, where women have suffered terribly because of it. And like the Q&A episode that you referred to earlier.
Yeah.
It's just flown. There's so much.
It was flashing red a while ago.
There's so much we haven't even, there's a chapter in your book about female violence, for example. There's a chapter about Indigenous women. It is such a comprehensive book. And the research that's gone into it is quite remarkable. So congratulations, Jess.
Thanks,
on this.
Sally.
And thank you again, Jess Hill.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Sally Warhuff and journalist Jess Hill, recorded live on Tuesday the 17th of September 2019. This series comes to you via the Wheeler Centre, Melbourne's home for conversations about books, writing and ideas. Check us out at wheelercentre.com. Until next time, take care.